The Athletic.
The only way to score is, of course, to play with a hand break off.
Hello, I'm Ian Stone. This is Handbreak Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Now, we normally like to theme each show, as you know, but it's been very busy in Arsenal land over the last 7 days, so we do feel like we need to be a bit more reactive today. So after a big week for the Arsenal, we've got the big hitters in. Amy Lawrence, Art de Roche and James Nicholas from The Athletic are here to pick the bones out of a great away win in Europe and then an even better home win over them from down the road. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
It's James McNicholas, though. Don't deprive him of his muck.
I did say McNicholas, did I not?
Really? Maybe.
Really?
I think it was Nicholas, but I was going to let it slide, Ian. I'm not fussy about this.
There's like protocols here and discipline that needs to be adhered to.
Yeah.
Somewhere
right,
around here might get dropped otherwise.
Oh dear, I've just done an over. All right then. Well, we are recording this podcast. We'll get to that. We're recording this podcast on the Monday afternoon, the day after, as you know, we came back from 1-0 down to win 2-1 in the North London derby. The big story before the game was, of course, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang's lateness, even though he drives a car that goes 180 miles an hour. So the opening question, tell us about a time you were late for an Arsenal game. Art, have you been late for an Arsenal game? You're a young person. You're a bit tardy with your timekeeping, aren't
you? I'm actually quite good, I think. I don't think I've been late.
Yeah?
'Cause before... I became, I guess, a professional journalist, you'd call it. I'd usually try and get in before even team news was announced. So I don't think I've ever been that late. Sorry to disappoint you.
It's all right. Well done. We're very, very proud of you, Art. James, what about you? When have you been late for games?
Oh, I'm late all the time.
Are you?
I'm late all the time, yeah. Well, certainly compared to the other writers, I'm quite late, I think. Maybe they're just being more professional than me. I don't know. But the instance I was thinking of was when I went, basically, I went to New York to do a live version of the Arsecast, and we were going to watch Arsenal versus Chelsea in a pub in New York with all these Arsenal fans. And my flight was delayed. And I think it was the game, I think Arsenal won 3-0. But Alexis Sanchez scored and Mesut Ozil scored that goal where he sort of volleyed it into the ground and it bounced over the keeper. And basically, I missed most of the action and I flew across the Atlantic to do it. So I then had to talk about a game live in front of 150 Arsenal fans who paid to be there that I hadn't really watched. So that was quite embarrassing.
I imagine there are one or two fans listening to this now just going... My God, you never would have known. He can blag it so well, yeah. As we can, of course.
It if he is.
You would know that we would know the details. Amy, have you been late for a game? You must have been.
I was once late in a way that really, really annoyed me, where I had to meet a friend of mine who had tickets near us, but I had his ticket, and he's always taking his time. And it's like there's five of us that had season tickets together, and we'd sort of take it in turns to wait for the late guy. And it was a Champions League game against Juventus. I think people might remember it for Bergkamp's assist to Ljungberg, a famous scooped assist. And guess which mug was outside the ground? That's how late. I think the goal might have been scored on the 21st minute. So that's how I was. I'm really, really not one of those people that handles standing outside the ground when the game is going on very well. I think I was quite miffed about that.
Painful.
What about you, Ian?
Well, a couple of quick stories. One where we weren't quite late, but almost. We'd arranged to fly up to Cardiff for the cup final. And we had a restaurant booked for about 1 o'clock. And then we had the plane had a flat tyre on the way up. So they had to go to another airport and pick up a front wheel and put it on the plane. And the plane left 3 hours late. We got to the game with about 2 minutes to spare. I think it was the one of the cup finals in Cardiff, possibly Chelsea, when Ray Parlour scored the goal. But the best bit about that was on the way back, we were sat on the plane waiting to leave. And the stewardess came on the tannoy and said, in the event of a decompression, oxygen will fall from the ceiling. And Keith Dover, who some of you may know, piped up oxygen. You couldn't even pump up a fucking tire on the way up, right? And the entire plane fell about laughing. But I made it for that one. The one I was actually late for, I think it was early 80s, Bolton away. There was tremendous problems on the train, and we got to the ground half an hour late, and I missed both goals in a one-all draw. And then there was a derailment on the way back, not of our train, but one in front of us, and I didn't get back till 4 in the morning, and I didn't wake up until 2:30 in the afternoon, missed the first half an hour of the game on Match of the Day. I've never seen the goals both times. I missed the goals both times. So very, very painful. Amy, tell us you've got one more.
Well,
while
I
we're
mean,
here.
I wasn't going to mention it, but I mean, obviously, it has to be noted that some of us missed the first 10 minutes of Anfield 89 because of the traffic. So I do have some sympathy with Aubameyang. You can't always get where you want to get in time.
Okay, well, that's duly, your sympathy is duly noted.
I realise I'm in quite a small minority. I don't think there's a lot of sympathy out there, but I don't know.
No, I wouldn't think there is. Now, right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £3.99 for a 6 month period. 40%, that is, 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. Go to theathletic.com/ArsenalPod to take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/ArsenalPod. Good and bad points about yesterday, obviously mainly good, and we'll start with those. Amy, they didn't get back from Greece till Friday morning, and then they put in a performance like that. I mean, that is quite impressive, the amount of running, hard running. You could see the last 10 minutes perhaps, and we'll get to that, but in general, they were a better team, and that's impressive with the long trip they had in midweek.
Actually, they didn't get back till Friday night.
Mm. Even more impressive then, isn't it? Really?
No, but this is quite interesting. Mikel Arteta's strategy for this was to try not to disrupt the usual rhythms and patterns and routines too much. Obviously, going over for a Thursday night game with a 3 or 4 hour flight kicked off 10 o'clock local time causes complications. So I think what they thought was the best plan was to stay in Greece overnight. They had a kind of warm down training session the following day in Greece, lunch, and then travel back in the afternoon. So there was really precious little time. But what they did do was not have one of those get back at 3-4 o'clock in the morning and feel totally mushed up with your system. So it was a risk to an extent, but like other risks that he took regarding this game, it was one that that paid off.
James, let's talk about some of the performances yesterday. Emile Smith Rowe on the left hand side. I just made a little note in our sort of joint document that we keep for this when we do the prep. I know some of you out there thinking, really? But we do. And that, how many runs he made and how the legs he's got. And I was sort of wondering whether, do you need that in a number 10 particularly? Maybe he's better off out on the left and then you can put Ødegaard in at number 10.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think they play the position in really different ways. And Smith Rowe does have these attributes that you maybe ordinarily associate more with a wide player. He's got that sprint. He's got that ability to interchange positions, to run beyond the defenders, to make the runs in behind. He can really dribble. If you think about your classic number 10, you know, you think of a Mesut Ozil or James Maddison, whoever it might be, they're not typically sprinters. They're not typically people who you think of as being great off the ball players. And Emile Smith Rowe absolutely is. And I thought he was brilliant in this left-sided role. He probably won't thank me for saying it because it's not his preferred position. He wants to be in the middle. He wants to be, you know, a central midfield player or an attacking midfield player in that middle third of the pitch. But he was so good. And the way he, you know, worked with Tierney, Tottenham's right-hand side was a bit of a weakness for them with Doherty there. And we exploited that superbly. I thought he was Arsenal's best player on the day. I think he created 4 chances. His pass completion rate was like 96% or something, which for a player who's operating primarily in the final third is pretty extraordinary. I just wish he got the reward he deserved with that shot that came off the woodwork, because that would have crowned an absolutely brilliant performance.
Yeah, I think we'd all agree. I mean, while James mentioned Kieran Tierney, I mean, immense again. I mean, he's obviously not scared of a North London derby. He's played in an Old Firm game, but his performances this year, that consistency, and I know that they were that on Match of the Day, they were talking about, or on Sky, they were talking about the bad defending for the first goal, for our first goal, but that was a tremendous bit of play by him down the left.
Yeah, and I think it's something everyone's come to get used to since he's come to the Premier League, especially, I think, after the game, I saw a tweet where someone compared his hesitation and then burst past the right back to a LeBron James clip. And I think it's just... if you get a chance, I retweeted it, so if you get a chance, go and see it. But just the confidence that he has on that left side, I think, is unrivaled. And just to speak to James's point about Smith Rowe as well, I think with Ødegaard in the team, even though you'd probably say they're both number 10s, Ødegaard also comes to the right side a lot as well, which gives...
Yes.
Smith Rowe the chance to get a bit more central, like he did for that shot that hit the crossbar. And I think just having that amount of creative options, including Tierney as well, because he's almost playing like a winger at times, especially for that goal against Benfica a few weeks ago. But I think when you have those amounts of creativity in the team, it only leads to positive things, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Amy, it was positive, and I think Art's point about when Ødegaard goes out right, and then Emil Smith Rowe, when he came onto that ball where he hit the bar, he sort of came from the centre of the pitch, didn't he?
Well, I just think it was what was so pleasing about it was that it felt like a slight conundrum, really, how you were going to squeeze these two talents in the same team and it be effective within the framework. And to start with, I think there was, you know, quite a few people were a little bit anxious that Ødegaard does seem to have a kind of a halo around him, as far as Arteta just loves him, it seems. He's played a lot of football since he came in. And,
last eight games.
Yeah.
Been picked.
And there was a slight worry maybe that Smith Rowe, who had been so instrumental to a kind of shift in the whole methodology of the way Arsenal were trying to play, being a little bit sidelined, either literally or figuratively. And... to see them both flourishing together on the pitch and the way they've sort of... I think clever players work stuff out. Clever players like to play with other clever players. Good players like to play with good players. That's a kind of basic. And it feels like they needed a little bit of time to figure out how they could both be really effective. And that, you know, Ødegaard is still, I think, improving and finding rhythm. It's the more he plays, the more comfortable he looks. I think he's regaining confidence that maybe got knocked a little bit when he went back to Madrid and wasn't playing that much, and that's normal. And for Smith Rowe to be kind of thrown into a slightly different position, and at the beginning it looked like it took a little bit away from his game, and then have the decision-making intelligence and drive to make sure he makes it work, to sort of reinvent himself, a bit like Saka did when he moved around and played different positions and you feel like you could play him anywhere and he'd be brilliant. Smith Rowe has shown that he's developed a knack to play in some different positions out there and be really important. And that's fantastic news. And I just think it was really pleasing as well that you're up against a team where it's, you know, Kane and Son and Bale and, you know, this much lauded, very experienced, much older sort of set of forwards. And Arsenal have got three youngsters out there who are all shining. Saka still, you know, wasn't maybe at his absolute best, but he does look a little bit tired. It's understandable. But what talent there is out on that pitch, and for them to have the personality to go and express that talent in a North London derby when the pressure's on, because the captain is a bit of a storm going on, and they just got on with the job brilliantly.
They did. No, I'd absolutely agree. James, I mean, Ødegaard is looking more comfortable. Two goals in 3-4 days, whatever it is. And would they have played that way if Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang had been better with his timekeeping? Would both of them have been in the team? And does it matter particularly? Maybe it's one of those happy accidents that suddenly Mikel Arteta looks at it and goes, OK, that's another option.
Yeah, we don't actually know at this point who Aubameyang would have started instead of. I mean, the assumption that I made was Lacazette, right? Because Aubameyang's been playing as kind of the spearhead of the attack.
But we know he's not that sort of player, don't we? Back to goal, holding the ball up, bringing other players into play, sort of forward.
No, so it's possible that he might have started on the left-hand side, in which case, Smith Rowe, I suppose, would have been the beneficiary stepping in. I don't know if it's fortuitous from Arteta or not that things panned out that way. I mean, funnily enough, I don't think Lacazette had a great game by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, but I think, you know, he tucks away the penalty, wins the penalty, and he tucks it away very, very nicely. But it's such an interesting thing, the Aubameyang situation, because if Arsenal don't win that game, I think, you know, the complexion of the discussion around it is very, very different.
I should say.
So whenever you make a big call like that, you really do need the result. Arteta got it this time. But I do think he is finding something in that balance behind the striker. You know, if you think back to before Christmas, we were all, you know, bemoaning the absence of creative talent in this team. Now, if you look at Saka, you look at Odegaard, you look at Smith Rowe, two of those players weren't here prior to, you know, Christmas, essentially. Well, Smith Rowe was, but wasn't being picked. Saka's now found this role on the right-hand side where before he was being shunted around the pitch. I think he has really stumbled upon something, this Arteta, and it is encouraging. I mean, if I look at our team yesterday, I look at the progress we've made in the last few weeks, I actually do feel quite optimistic, as particularly because some of these players are really young. I mean, Odegaard's coming from Real Madrid, but he's still only 22.
Yes.
And you make the point about him playing a lot of football and Arteta being, you know, very much praising him at every opportunity. But I think that's probably because there's a bit of a charm offensive going on. You know, if they want to keep him, they've got quite a job on their hands to convince him to leave Real Madrid and come to North London. So I do wonder how much that might be a factor in selection and certainly in the way Arteta talks about the player in his press conferences. We've basically got a few months to convince him this might be the place for him going forward.
Well, I guess we'll see, like you say, in the coming months. I'm assuming we've all watched Jermaine Jenas getting a bit teary on Match of the Day over the penalty. Do we think it was a penalty?
I think you have to. The only answer is yes, I guess.
The only answer is yes.
On this podcast, especially. But yeah, as soon as Lacazette's gone down, I was actually watching the game with my mum. It's one of the first times I've actually let her in the room, because basically she's all usually a sense of bad luck for Arsenal games. So
she was there for this one.
Yeah, so I get quite superstitious sometimes.
Well, then she...
But
she has to stay in it from now on. Yeah. Okay, I think that's Mrs. De Roche. I'm sorry, but you're going to be watching a lot of Arsenal games for the foreseeable future.
It's fine. She's an Arsenal fan, so she'll be happy about that, and I'll let her know. But yeah,
good.
As soon as Lacazette went down, I turned to her and said, "That's a penalty." I've just waited for the confirmation, basically. So I think we've come to get used to that from Jermaine Genius over the years. I think. The Chelsea FA Cup semi-final in 2017, if I'm remembering correctly, is another example. But definitely a penalty. Even Tottenham fans were admitting it in the comments to his tweet about it during the game. So I don't think he can have much to complain about.
You won't get any disagreement from me. I'm assuming, Amy and James, you feel the same way. And it's the sort of penalty, Amy, that if it was... for your team, you want it to be given against your team, you'd feel a little bit of grief, perhaps.
Yeah, I also feel that, you know, I'm not saying there's been a scientific count here, but it does feel like about 100 penalties that Arsenal could have had this season, they've not been given one reason or another. Yeah. Mm. So
Peters for Burnley the other week.
Dearie me. I mean, on countless examples. It's a bit like the banished, undiscussed subject of Harry Kane's... how do we call it? Body charge against Gabriel. I mean, you know, there are things that go on that often don't get due attention. Let's just say,
yes.
I didn't see there was much cause for too many tears for that penalty decision.
No, I don't suppose you would.
Unlike Art's mum, I wasn't in the room. Actually, it's a reverse scenario. I was dying for the loo, and about a minute before the penalty, I thought, I'm just going to run up to the loo. And I said to the kids, I said, don't do that stupid thing where you go, oh, it's a goal, like as soon as someone leaves the room.
Love your kids.
And yeah, so do I. And of course, there was much screaming. I thought, oh, for God's sake, I thundered down the stairs. And it was a penalty. So yay, happy days. And wasn't it a great penalty, by the way? It was a really, really fantastic
really
strike
good,
penalty.
Yeah.
It was the first decent connection he had with the ball all game, but I'll take that, right?
A word for Pepe's pass as well, I think, that led to the penalty. I think it was unreal.
Absolutely, I agree. By the way, Tom Hickey said, I watched the North London derby from Connecticut yesterday and managed to get my partner to join me for most of it. We equalised as soon as she joined and then the rest is history. It isn't the first time this has happened. I think she might be a bit of an Arsenal talisman. Do any of you have superstitions about watching Arsenal, people you always never want to watch with? Tom Hickey sent that. All I did is I got the cat not to sit on my lap because I'm not a calm place when I'm watching a North London derby. But just by the way, I don't know if anyone else, any others of you have superstitions? I don't suppose you do, really. We're all,
not once I share on this podcast.
No, quite. James, you mentioned Gabriel, did you not?
That header. Oh, my God. I love him.
He put down a marker.
What was that?
The header the other day was fantastic, and Villa can lie there all
the
he wants.
Like the header to stop Tottenham from getting a jammy equaliser. That was
a magnificent,
incredible.
Yes. I agree. The blot near the end as well. I'll ask you, James, do you think he's first choice now, Gabriel, with those two performances that he's given?
I think he's been really good. It's tough, isn't it, with the Arsenal centre-backs? I feel like there's quite close competition. I mean, Pablo Marie's barely put a foot wrong in the games that he's played. I thought he might come back into the team at the weekend.
Rob Holding did very well when he played for us. He had a couple of mistakes, but he's been doing well.
And it's been quite quick, hasn't it? He's gone from playing almost every minute in the Premier League to now feeling a bit like he might be kind of fourth in the queue, maybe behind Marie, Louise and Gabriel. So it's close, the centre-backs. And I think there are different combinations. But I have to say, I thought Gabriel came through this week really strongly. And I think that's good because he's a player with a big future. He's a young guy. He arrived in England, had a really good start, then a little bit shakier. That's to be expected in the first season. There's going to be a period of adaptation. But I thought he was very good yesterday. And for 75 minutes, he dominated Harry Kane. And actually, I think that the foul that Harry Kane makes on Gabriel, which is really bad, I think it's a really egregious foul, is born out of frustration because Kane could not get a kick. You know, this was unusual for Tottenham to not be able to get Kane into the game at all. And he was so dangerous in the reverse fixture. You know, he set up so many chances for Son on the counter-attack. The way we marshalled him in this game, for the vast majority, was a lot better. And I think a lot of that was down to Gabriel. Of course, in the final 10 minutes or so, everything went slightly to pieces. Well, the less said about that, the better.
Well, no. That's a strange intro because I was going to talk about it, to be honest with you.
Oh, okay, right. Okay. No, because the more said about that, the better.
I mean, it did seem to start. I thought there was a moment when Gabriel misplaced a pass to Cedric in about the 77th, 78th minute, and it all seemed to go downhill from there. Cedric, by the way, had a decent game as well yesterday, but that last 10 minutes, that was... Do you agree with David Luiz, Art, that it was down to the young players and the way he said it on Match of the Day, it was the way they played with emotion? I mean, do you agree with that analysis?
Yeah, well, even with the mistakes, I remember one, maybe it was just after the one you mentioned, but Thomas Partey trying to play the ball back to Luiz, yes. And he's absolutely lost it. And I think moments like that, we just have to cut out of the game, really. And I think even against Olympiacos, they were still there with David Luiz himself, and then the mix-up with Danny Ceballos and Bernd Leno. And it's just... Yes, I do agree with Luiz to an extent in terms of the young players playing with emotion. That's getting Arsenal through certain moments. But again, you actually need your senior players to see through the more pressurised moments, I guess you'd say, towards the end of matches. And even Mikel Arteta admitted that the way Arsenal are managing those types of situations aren't that good. And I think those are the moments that are probably a bit more in the limelight when you look at these things.
You know what, Amy, I'm just thinking about it. We do, most weeks, we talk about problems that Arsenal have. You know, defensive issues, giving the ball away, not scoring enough. But it does feel like progress, does it not? The way that we seem to address these problems. We still make mistakes, but everyone does, don't they?
Just in this last week, I think, to be able to twice in a row come back from, you know, a big disappointment, albeit disappointments with different flavours, giving away a silly goal in Greece and then conceding a... you know, a very good goal, but a very annoying one because you've been on top for all the game and Tottenham haven't had much of a sniff. It showed a lot of resilience for Arsenal to just keep plugging away and work their way back into both matches to win. So that is a plus. I think if I do have this feeling with Arsenal, though, that the next thing they need to do, really, and James talked about how this is a, you know, evolving team. You look at the even during the course of the season, how the personnel has been shifting and... but to make real sustained progress has got to be the next goal, because it feels like Arsenal are quite good at taking a step up the ladder and everybody goes, oh, look, that's been a great week, you know. Now what? Now look, if they can only win the next game and then the next game and looking at the table and you kind of lull yourself into trying, you know, to imagine a genuine upward curve, that's the point at which Arsenal have a crap game. Usually against whoever.
Yes.
So it wasn't dissimilar very, very recently to go and win against Benfica and then win away at Leicester, which was a really, really good result. Everyone's getting excited again. And suddenly it's going and having a rubbish 1-1 draw at Burnley with a very flat performance. So it's a difficult ask with what's in front of Arsenal in the next games. But
started well, haven't we?
I would like one of these days that we're sitting here and you're talking about a really good month instead of a really good week. And yes, step by step, actually extend and prolong this sense of progress.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We were a bit with the handbrake at the time.
A couple of negatives from yesterday. James, you did send out a tweet at, I think, just past midday or something, when you managed to photograph Oba's, is it a Lamborghini, is it? Or some, I don't know what it is.
It's a Ferrari.
Ridiculous supercar.
He's got one of everything, to be fair.
He's got more than one. He's got a number of those cars with different holograms on. But you photographed one of those cars crawling along Muswell Hill towards the roundabout at something like 8 minutes past 12. Now we realise he was late. I mean, anyone who's lived in London longer than, certainly North London longer than 10 minutes knows that you never go around North. It's always busy around the Muswell Hill roundabout. But so he was late. Mikel Arteta dropped him from the team, made him sit there, didn't even bring him on when he replaced Lacazette late in the game. I mean, he's very into his discipline, isn't he? Do you think this is maybe not the first time that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has been late for a game?
It's definitely not the first misdemeanor on Aubameyang's part. And, you know, some of those incidents have been reported previously. There was a missed COVID test, for example. And I think as the club captain, you know, Mikel Arteta, you're right. He's really hot on this stuff. He's trying to implement this kind of new cultural ideas at the club. I think he thinks it's essential that the skipper leads by example. And consequently, he can't make any exemptions for him, you know, if he fails to abide by the rules. So... I think it was a really bold call from Arteta. Not
could
have
just gone
to,
very badly wrong, couldn't it? Let's be fair.
Not just to leave Aubameyang out, but also to make the reason why public. I mean, I'm sure there have been many instances in the past where Arsenal managers have left players out, but you know they haven't necessarily given the real reasons why, and it's quite easily done. It's very easy to cite a muscle strain or fatigue or tactical reasons. How many times have we heard that? Tactical reasons about a player's omission. Arteta didn't do that, and he sort of put his head on the block a little bit there by saying, look, I've taken this decision. It's on my authority. And if you win, of course, it looks great. And I think, personally, I'm okay with it. I know not everyone feels the same. I know some people feel that maybe Arteta is a little bit too didactic in this respect, that he's a little bit too strict, almost schoolmasterly. I think that it's probably, on balance, a good thing. I think if you speak to enough people who've been around Arsenal over the past, going back away now, you could be talking over 10 years really, there has been a sense in which the culture around the club has been a little bit cushy, a little bit soft, you know. And I think having someone at the top working from the top down, who has a slight disciplinarian element to them, I think at this point in the club's life is a good thing. And so I respect the stand that Mikel Arteta took, and I think it's right that nobody should be exempt from it.
I just wish he hadn't done it just before kickoff of the North London derby, though. I must say I absolutely was a nervous wreck, really, thinking, why would you do that? Why would you, why would you consciously
you were always
disrupt?
Gonna be.
Yeah, but right, that's true. But why would you consciously disrupt detonate a grenade just before a kickoff of a North London derby? Like, just do it after. Like, say whatever you want afterwards. I thought it was immensely... let's just say it was on that fine line between being very brave and being very foolish, because it could easily have backfired. Because had Arsenal not won the game, and then there would have been this whole sense of like a big drama behind the scenes contributing to that. I felt it was timing wise that I don't have any issues with wanting to set high standards of discipline and including the captain as that and believing that they should set by example. Absolutely. But just maybe after the game rather than before. It just makes me wonder if, I know there was something almost pointed about it, like I have a desire to make this public. So whether there had been private attempts to solve these kind of things previously that hadn't worked and therefore it felt like this was a necessary next step, I don't know. But it's still a very, very interesting one because, you know, Arteta's got to be confident that Aubameyang's going to kind of come back happily into the fold, because it could do without a big problem, let's just say.
I think one of the things that's tricky is at this stage, we don't know precisely what he was late for. But if you think about the fact that Arsenal had so little lead time going into this game, you know, we talk about them coming back from Greece late on the Friday. They basically got recovery the next day. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that they were meeting up on the Sunday at the Emirates Stadium to talk through, you know, fairly detailed, important tactical plans. So in that respect, if you're about to start doing that, and one of the players you're intended to pick isn't there, but you've got Alex Lacazette sat there in the room, maybe it is the responsible management to say, well, I'll work with what I've got.
Lee Dixon, by the way, tweeted yesterday, and I'm looking at the timeline. It looks like he tweeted after the game when obviously it worked out. Arteta was right to drop Oba in my book, regardless of the result. The integrity of the team and its values have to be maintained. No one bigger than the group. It has to be that way, in my opinion. It worked, but as Amy and James have been saying, it could have gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, and I think the point you brought up earlier, Ian, as to would the plan have gone as well without Aubameyang in the side, I think the Leeds game last month probably shows that it could have went just as well, if not better, because in that game, Aubameyang scores a hat-trick, yes. I believe, and yes. Smith Rowe and Odegaard both play very important roles in the win. And I think, of course, Leeds aren't as great a side as Tottenham, but there probably is cause to believe that Aubameyang could have done just as good a job, if not better, than Lacazette did against Tottenham yesterday. But in terms of just laying down the law, the only kind of issue I had with it was, if you're going to drop him, why put him on the bench and not bring him on if you've got someone like Eddie Nketiah, who's played in the under-23s on the Friday night, or Gabriel Martinelli, who seems to be like a figment of our imaginations at the moment, who just can't seem to get a game. And I think I did ask Arteta about it a few weeks back after the Leicester game, and he said basically it was about getting him in at the right moments, and it just when you don't bring him on against Olympiacos in midweek or against Tottenham or in any other games before that, it just makes you wonder when is the right time to actually give Martinelli those minutes, maybe with a very encouraging scoreline in the Europa League against Olympiacos. That could happen in the second leg. But that was my only kind of question about what happened. I wasn't really too thrown, I guess is the word, by him being dropped because of the reasons that Arteta cited. I was okay with that. It's just about how, I guess, he went about solving the issue.
I mean, let's talk about the forwards then. Andrew Dyer has written to us. It's easy to overlook this considering the joy of the past two results, but how serious of a problem is Arsenal's current failure to convert many of the clear-cut chances they create? We almost paid for it again yesterday. Amy, that is a fair point. Maybe this maybe leads into more of a discussion about an upgrade to our number nine, to Alex Lacazette.
Maybe. I just don't know how much funding there's going to be for major transfers this summer, so it's quite difficult to know what Arsenal are capable of. But I suppose it's the old adage, if you're making the chances, then hopefully things start to click. You know, what I like about recently is different players have been scoring as well. It did feel for a long time like there was so much onus on the goals to come from Aubameyang largely.
Yes.
And when you're...
This is encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, look at, you know, because we're recording now and we're focused on what happened yesterday, you know, that we haven't spoken much about the Olympiacos game much, but Mo Elneny, people, come on, show some love.
It was marvellous, wasn't it? It was a beautiful moment.
It's been really healthy to see the goals coming from, you know, from different areas. You know, in Greece, you had a Gabriella defender scoring an absolutely brilliant goal. Mo Elneny, who is ostensibly a defensive midfield player, but he was kind of roaming around all over the place. And Odegaard, who's, you know, needed to add goals to his game, someone in that kind of creative midfield slot. So it's really helpful that there's more spread, and let's hope that there's just a bit more confidence to be taking more shots, and hopefully that the, you know, maybe a few more shooting sessions would be good, just to refine things a bit. But it feels like things are heading in the right direction, in that not that long ago it didn't feel like Arsenal were creating many chances at all, and that was much worse.
No, in part of the notes for this, James, I wrote, Jose Mourinho was so negative, I'd rather die than have him as an Arsenal manager, is what I wrote. At Follow Jasper has a long memory, though. He says, I know it makes me petty, but I will never forgive Stoney saying we should have gone with Mourinho over Arteta. Says
Harry
Kane
is
a cheat, pass it on. Yeah, I can't disagree. It was, I thought they would be more attacking than they were, but was it partly, James, to do with the fact that especially on the left hand side we are so attacking ourselves, it pushes them back?
I think there's an extent to which that's the case. I mean, it was odd. I did think Mourinho approached this game in a slightly strange manner. He picked what looked like a very attacking lineup
and then played defensively.
Approached it, yeah, and kind of got caught between two stools, really. And I know a lot of Tottenham fans are pretty aggrieved about the approach that he took in the game. And actually, when you look at the last 15 minutes, what they achieved with 10 men suggests that had they come at us a little bit more, you know, I think there could have been something in it for them. Listen, I don't want to give too much of the credit for this result to Tottenham's deficiencies. I'd rather put it down to Arsenal's excellence. And I think you're right to say that flank was a really important part of it. And I don't want the... the kind of anxiety of the last 10 minutes to colour my interpretation of the game too much, because I really do think until that point Arsenal were by far the better side. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned not taking chances, that's certainly true, but they were also unlucky in some instances with Smith Rowe from range and Cedric from the edge of the box. A really good effort, a really good effort actually, because he does well to get to the ball. Yeah. Let alone get the shot away. And so I think, you know, Arsenal were the better team on the day, and back to front, really, apart from that awkward end period.
Awkward.
Yeah, and actually, while you say that about the left, and I think that's a really good point, something I've observed recently is that I think we are, for a long time, the left has been our stronger flank. We talked about the idea of being an unbalanced team. I think the right side is improving. Yeah. And what's encouraging is it's improving with different combinations on the field. You know, we've seen Cedric and Pepe in the second half yesterday. We know those two players have quite a good chemistry and a good understanding. We've seen Saka interacting well with Cedric and with Bellerin too. I think Martin Odegaard helps provide that balance because, as mentioned, he likes to drop out to the right and combine on that side. So I think there are indicators that, you know, we're looking like a more balanced team than we have for the vast majority of the season.
Things are looking up. By the way, follow Jasper. I am sorry, by the way, that you will never forgive me, but I'm here for the foreseeable future. So you're just going to have to live with it, I guess. We should also pass on our congratulations to Emil Smith-Rowe and Eddie Nketiah for making the under-21 squad for the Euros group stage. Although Eddie doesn't appear to be getting much of a chance with Arsenal at the moment. He's not the only Arsenal forward, as Art mentioned as well. I mean, general question, Amy, I'll ask you this: does this mean Saka's probably full England squad for the foreseeable? I mean, I guess he has to be, doesn't he?
Yeah, it would be mad not to. Yeah, I think Saka and Foden are way out of the sphere of playing under 21 junior football anymore.
Well said. Art, we're going to let you go at this point. Thanks very much for joining us, as always.
Thanks for having me. Hope I was a good inclusion this week, and look forward to hearing what you guys get up to in part two.
We were a bit with the handbrake at time.
This is Handbrake Off, the Arsenal podcast, brought to you by The Athletic. Art de Rocher has left us, but still here with Amy Lawrence and James McNicholas. Now, before we get going, again, we have to address the elephant in the room. No greater legend than Ian Wright has broken into song, or Broken Bad, if your name is Amy Lawrence. Now, many listeners have been wondering how Amy has taken this. And how much of a shine was taken off the day by Ian Wright's endorsement of Sweet Caroline, said Tim Scales. Dan Shaw also got involved. And Nicholas Arm. Want to hear your reaction, Amy, to Wrighty singing Sweet Caroline.
I'm heartbroken, I have to say.
It's horrible when your heroes let you down.
You know, as people probably know by now, there is no limits to my love for Ian Wright. What can I say? I was really disappointed. I was sorry because I think we could have done with him on our side of the campaign. So yeah, it's never something I will. It's always going to be endured. It's never going to be enjoyed, as far as I'm concerned. That song, may it rot in hell. Luckily, it's that I can separate these two things in my own brain. My love for Ian Wright is untainted, but the song remains evil.
Okay, James, I know you're not as bothered about this as Amy.
The problem is, I think I'm quite a suggestible person because I sort of get swept up in it, whatever happens. They could have played anything at full time there and I would have been carried along in the moment just because I was so happy to have won the game. So yeah, I'm not the best person.
No. Well, I certainly shouldn't because I love that tune. Yeah. I want it. I have it playing on a loop all the time. I just walk around the house with headphones.
Is it sung by Jose Mourinho? It's,
in my head, it is sung by Jose Mourinho. I know what you're doing there. I'm not rising to the bait. Anyway, one thing I did want to talk about, by the way, and thanks for writing in, Nicholas and Dan and Tim. We appreciate, especially when you're taking the piss out of Amy. Art wrote a piece. He talked about the fact that Arsenal created plenty of chances, but they can't keep defending like this. He was talking specifically about the mistakes we made against Olympiacos on Thursday night. We gave away another silly goal after the Burnley goal. We could have given away a couple more. James, I mean, how do we keep getting away with it? I mean, we don't, to be honest, but we can't keep doing this.
And you know what's weird as well? In the Spurs game, we had 11 versus 10. And you thought, right, we'll just knock it around at the back. And then we started going long. I was like, we had no centre-forward on. I was tearing what's left of my hair out. Couldn't understand it. It is kind of maddening and fascinating. And I sort of look forward to seeing how Arsenal conspire to concede a goal next. At least there were no so obviously egregious errors in this match. It is interesting. I do just sort of think we have certain players that have capacity to make these kinds of mistakes. And, you know, the likes of Luiz and Xhaka, they're players that in some respects I really admire. But in other respects, I think we have to know what we've got with them and accept that these are part of the package. And as long as they're regular starters, we're probably going to have this discussion every 8 weeks, wondering how they've done what they've done.
I mean, we said it, Amy, the Burnley game, you know, we let in a stupid, stupid goal when Leno passed to Xhaka. But there was also the goal against Burnley was us playing out from the back and suddenly we're on the break. So I'm glad they're doing it. Maybe we just have to accept the mistakes will happen. And as someone pointed out on TV yesterday, the mistakes that we make always seem to result in goals. That's not the case with other teams.
Maybe, but I mean, we're interested in Arsenal, and let's be honest, the number of mistakes that leads to goals is unsustainable. It's ludicrous. I'm intrigued by Arteta's insistence, you know, almost on point of principle. This is what we do, you know, we'll work it out. If Arsenal can win the Europa League this year, playing that way, all the credit in the world to Mikel Arteta. But if somewhere along the line, they make a stupid mistake like they did at Olympiacos and then don't recover from it, it will be quite frustrating, really. So, and like James says, it's tricky because you feel like it's partly down to style of play, which is a choice, and it's partly down to the nature of personnel, which are players who have a mixture of qualities and a sort of self-destruct button. All wrapped up in the same package. And that's Arsenal right now. But it was really, really pleasing against Olympiacos to get not just the second, but the third goal. I think they didn't look like very, very strong opponents. And you think if you're giving weak opponents easy gifts, you can't, you're not always going to get away with it. But I was very pleased that Arsenal got the sort of cushion that I think really helps, hopefully, to make sure that the second leg is not nervy, because I'm always wary of second legs where you're at home. Although you're supposed to have the advantage, there does seem
against
that
against Olympiacos.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not like we haven't seen it before. So
No.
But against many other teams as well, it's such a precarious position. So hopefully,
I mean, it is also...
hopefully there's enough damage that's been done in that first game.
I mean, that's the feeling, isn't it, James? I'm feeling fairly confident. There are fine margins, though, as we know. At 1-1 in the game against Olympiacos after that ridiculous goal, Hector Bellerin made an absolutely splendid block to keep it down, to keep it at 1-1. 2-1, that's a very, very different game and a very, very different second leg.
Yeah, and that's what's so maddening about the mistakes Arsenal make. They seem to resuscitate the teams they're playing. You know, they breathe life into them suddenly. I do think that the lead Arsenal have should be enough at this stage. Famous last words, but yeah, I feel confident heading in.
Let's have a song then before we go, having beaten Olympiacos on Thursday and beaten Spurs yesterday. Let's have a song. James, start with you.
Well, there's been this slight trend at the Emirates Stadium recently of after players scoring, having a song. And my strong suspicion is the players might have a hand in the songs that are played for them. When Lacazette scored the winning penalty yesterday, there was a little blast of a track called Highest in the Room by Travis Scott. So I picked that.
Good. Okay. By the way, we had a couple of people write in. Callum Clues said, better not look down, BB King. And Kyle at Destructible Cake suggests, don't cry for me, Jermaine Genus. Not really a song, but we'll take it. We know what you mean. Thank you, Kyle. Amy, what about you?
Well, it is a song for Jermaine Genus as it goes. A great one. Frankie Knuckles. So many tears.
When the curtain comes down and the circus is through, no one is left but me, you, and all my tears. So many tears, my tears.
I am having Rizzle Kicks, always late, because for Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, and also because they're gooners as well. That's it. Thank you to Art de Roche. Thank you, Amy and James. And thanks to Taya, our producer. I'm Ian Stone. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
The Athletic.